Welcome to Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. I'm Laura Snapes.
And I'm Fraser McAlpine.
How are you, Fraser? It's extremely early.
Yes, we're recording this week at 7 o'clock in the morning due to scheduling issues. And so consequently, our voices are a little bit weird, but our brains are as sharp as ever.
Yes, I've got some coffee on the go, so if there's any tapping, that's what it is. Just frantically trying to wake up.
A massive vat of coffee each. So on this week's agenda, we've got a quick swizz through a pretty stagnant top 10, and then serious business, Harry Styles' debut solo single, and a brief history of solo debuts from former boy band and girl band members.
So there's only one girl band member, isn't there? An honorary member of the boy band.
But her contribution is significant, I think. We had a bit of a debate as to whether to include it, which we won't go into now. But yeah, it's enough to... It contains enough relevant information to make it worth discussing.
They've got a lot to look forward to.
Oh, they have.
Shall we move on to the official UK top 10?
Yes.
Which is very similar to the week before, so we're going to whiz through it. And number 10 is Julia Michaels and Issues, which is steadily climbing up the charts. I have to admit that every week when I see its name, I've forgotten what it sounds like and I have to listen to it again.
No, you're absolutely right. There's something forgettable about it, even though there is a chart. There are many solo artists with just first name, second name chart names. And, you know, it's a single word song title. It's a crowded field in which to try and stand out. And this song nearly does it, but doesn't.
I wonder how consciously they were getting close to the production style of Clean Bandit, because this could very easily be one of their songs, I think. Those kind of very elegant string plucks that, I mean, that's the whole song, really.
The thing with Clean Bandit is that you wouldn't expect them, that the formula that they've picked upon in order to make pop music is so unlikely. You know, there are classical musicians and sort of one big dance music guy, and they've decided to work together on making pop music. Shouldn't work at all. Or if it does work, should only work to create spectacularly po-faced records that nobody, you know, would really get any joy from. And they've actually not done that. They've created some incredibly joyful... Rather Be is an astonishing pop song. But that sort of sets a bar for what is possible within pop music. And I think that's the bar that Julia Michaels is sort of pushing towards. We have a sheet that we work from when we're making this podcast, and we ask ourselves questions and things like that. It's an exciting way to work. And Laura's written on this. You wonder how many people know she wrote all those other songs, which made me just go back and check the list of other songs that Julia Michaels has written. And I'd forgotten that she wrote Sorry for Justin Bieber, which I always think of as being this incredibly... It's incredibly well-tailored song to what personality Justin Bieber seems to have, because it's such a passive-aggressive way of apologising to someone. And it feels to me like an entitled man way of saying sorry for whatever it is that he's done, by saying, is it too late now? Is it too late to say sorry, first of all? So would it do any good if I apologised? And secondly, because I'm missing more than just your body.
It's like, so teenage and petulant.
Yeah, exactly. So it fits what people think Justin Bieber's character is. But it had never occurred to me before who had written the song, because it's so tailored to Justin Bieber. And the fact that it's written by a woman seems really interesting suddenly, because it just seems such a mannish thing to do. But you ascribe it as being a teenage thing, so that maybe is just my filter.
Oh, no, it's definitely a teenage boyish thing, I think. Also, yeah. That must be so much fun, the writing exercise of being told, right, that you're writing a song for Justin Bieber, you know where he's at in his personal life, you have to write something that seems congruent to that. I mean, I don't really know anything about Julia Michaels, but you could imagine it's the kind of task you might go into, tongue very much in cheek, thinking, what can I get away with here?
Yeah. He's a boy prince, and he thinks that everybody, he can tell the whole world off whenever he's slightly peeved at it. Okay then, now apply that to a relationship and off you go.
More Bieber later on when we get to the Selena Gomez part. So at number 9 is Zedd featuring Alicia Cara with Stay, which is also climbing up the chart. I have to say that there's a lot of lyrics in the chart at the moment about people putting their hands on each other's body, and I would say this is definitely the number one example of that, in my opinion. The chorus goes, "Just take your time, the clock is ticking, so stay. All you have to do is wait a second, your hands on mine, the clock is ticking." And it's not doesn't really elevate it that much, but just the juxtaposition of clock hands and human hands, I thought was quite smart, considering all of the quite gropey tracks going on at the moment.
Yeah, that's the classy way to grope somebody with a watch on.
Moving on to a song that I think avoids anything like that by being so severely anodyne is at number 8 is Martin Jensen's Solo Dance, which I think the enduring success of this song really tests us as podcasters, doesn't it?
Well, yes, because it, there's nothing. I mean, actually, this week we've got a thing, which is that it contains two memes, sort of musical memes that are very are worth commenting on. One is very nowadays, which is the oh melody is a melody that exists only in nowadays pop music. It wouldn't have existed 10 years ago or before then. That it, there's an element of melody there. It's probably got a proper musical term. I don't know what it is.
Is that what they call the millennial whoop? I read an article about this and I didn't really understand what it was trying to get to. I saw a lot of people saying it was pretty spurious. But I mean, I definitely have noticed that pattern coming through pop. I think it's a result of Caribbean influence being repurposed by Scandinavian pop stars. And that kind of being that tone in their voice being like a natural development of the Scandinavian accents attempt to reprocess a Jamaican influence. And now it's been totally disembodied from any sense of words and is just this thing that flares up in songs, kind of like a little flag waving to be like, yes, very current, very on trend. But I'm not sure if that's a millennial whoop, but I did think that was spurious anyway.
It's an interesting thing because you can't really trace some of that stuff. I think you have to be incredibly confident to trace some of that, those ideas, and say, well, that's definitely from... That's definitely a Swedish person singing a Caribbean hook. I mean, you have to be so sure of both cultures to not, you know, because music is quite simple in a way. And the stuff that people find beguiling in music tends to be quite simple as well. But pop evolution being what it is, an idea will be introduced into one hit song and it will just suddenly start popping up in other hit songs until there's a theme. So actually the other meme that's in the song, which is, the fact that they sing the word Ayo was in every pop song, more or less, from in 2007 to 2009. There were just tons of pop songs that had that Ayo thing. Ayo Technology by 50 Cent and Justin Timberlake has it. Dynamite by Ty Cruz has it. And it was as ubiquitous at that point as mentioning that you were in the club was ubiquitous as a lyrical meme. They possibly do come from one person's misinterpretation of another culture, but I would be so wary of saying that's definitely how it happened, because it seems there's an element of, I don't know. It's like trying to find the original derivation of words. Actually, the important thing is not the first time it was done. It's why everybody suddenly grabs hold of it and starts reusing it, I think.
Oh, yeah. I think juxtaposing those two things in this song, I think you can see it's really it's clearly trying to do two things. Like, never mind where the sounds came from. The AO part, like you say, is very much like, this is a club song. But then that oh, whoa, whoa, whoa thing. That sound recurring in pop at the moment, it always seems to say to me that something is kind of anthemic and euphoric, but it's also about togetherness and kind of hopefulness. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but there's it reminds me of... It's like a development of all of those very fey folksy sound that kind of came off the back of adverts and was very much like, we're all people together. And I think this is the next logical step of that sound.
Yeah, I would say that was fair. I think that's definitely why it's there. And it also suggests a song that has been written by professional songwriters, because they are, again, tailoring, bringing in the best. You know, it's that feeling of bringing in the best materials to fit the person's frame, and they're saying, well, would you like to try this season's cut? This is the oh, whoa, whoa cut. This is what we're bringing into pop music these days. You know, so it doesn't have the spark of genuine inspiration, which sounds like, you know, a horrible art critic way of looking at things, but it's incredibly effective and it does its job.
Yeah. So, I mean, apart from Ed Sheeran, Martin Jensen and Julia Michaels have had the most tweets and the most weeks in the chart of any song that's currently in the top 10. So Ed Sheeran has two songs that have been in the top, been in the chart for 13 weeks, whereas Martin Jensen and Julia Michaels have both been in the chart for 11. So yeah, I don't think this one's going to go away anytime soon.
No, no, and good luck to it.
Good luck to us continuing to talk about it.
Next week, who knows what we'll find to say about it.
At number 7 is Kygo and Selena Gomez and It Ain't Me. Are you a fan of this one?
Yeah. Again, though, it's one of those songs that I find myself having to refresh my memory of whenever we come back to looking at it. So perhaps it's not burrowing its way in as deeply as it could be.
Yeah, the one thing I do, I mean, I'm not a wild fan of the song, but I like the way that it's structured. The way that the first verse is building up, you think that, you know, she is going to be there to walk him home in the middle of the night and kind of hold his hand and be by his side. But then the chorus is just like, it ain't me. No, I'm not going to be here and do those things for you anymore. And I think coming back to Bieber, that's a feeling you'd be quite familiar with if you'd been out with him. And I think she does she does convey the weariness of the situation very well.
Yeah, you promised me the earth and now you're doing this. Okay.
Number 6, Ed Sheeran and Castle on the Hill.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, this is a difficult song to continue to talk about because it's a fairly straightforward idea.
Have you watched any of, this sounds slightly off topic, but I will get to a point. Have you watched any of Harry Hill's Alien Fun Capsule that's on ITV at the moment?
No, I haven't. I don't even know anything about it.
It's brilliant. I mean, a typical Harry Hill style. It's one of the strangest primetime TV shows I've ever seen. I think it's on Wednesdays or Thursdays. And it is supposedly a game show, but it doesn't really have rounds particularly. And there's two teams and they're both made up of celebrities, but one of the celebrity guests is always very old. I can't remember who it was the week before. I think it was Angela Rippon, maybe. But then this week's one was Des O'Connor, just looking quite bewildered by everything that was going on. For some reason, I mean, this really is getting off topic, but there was a part on it where they strapped a little box to his face and he had to guess, and there was a hole in the side of the box, and Harry Hill was going to insert either a sausage or a chipolata, and he had to guess with restricted view whether it was a sausage or chipolata. So, you know, that's kind of the level of derangement they're talking about on this show. But they kind of cast back to Des O'Connor's singing career and played a few of his songs, which are all just lists of people's names, lists of things, like, reeled off one after the other. And it struck me that Ed Sheeran is very much the king of song-based list-making. It's not only kind of the homogeneity of sentiment, but also the delivery where, like, screaming to Tiny Dancer in this song is no more important than the line that comes after it. With every song, it's just like he's got a big handful of seed and he's throwing it out to the pigeons and just seeing who's going to catch what.
Yeah, this song goes out to anybody that broke their leg once while running and then smelt the grass and thought the grass smelt nice, even though they had a broken leg at the time. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And it just put a visual image in my head of Ed Sheeran in 40 years' time with a box around his face. But then, as soon as you start talking about people putting boxes around your face, I start thinking of Room 101 in 1984. So instead of trying to insert a chipolata, it was an actual live rat, which is perhaps a little bleak, but we've only just woken up.
I would be fine with somebody putting a live rat in a small box on Ed Sheeran's face. I hope that's not cruel, but, you know, that's TV I'd watch.
Yeah, well, there you go. I think we found our podcast's second strap line there. Unbreak My Chart. I would be fine to put a box around Ed Sheeran's face with a live rat in it. Tune in next week.
At number 5 is the Chainsmokers and Coldplay with Something Just Like This, which is also rising up the chart somehow, though it's not actually been around as long as I thought it had. It's only been on the chart 5 or 6 weeks.
Yes, just long enough to fend off the Ed Sheeran apocalypse. I think, though, you know, we give props every week, but I think we should continue to do so. This is the sterling effort by the plucky young upstarts Coldplay. just to fend off an absolute invasion. They are the sole Saxon church in 1066 that the Normans didn't burn.
At number 4 is Drake with Passion Fruit. I am a big fan of this song.
Yeah, big tick. Well done, Drake.
Another big tick for at number 3, Clean Bandit featuring Zara Larsson with Symphony. I think this has possibly the nicest melody of any song in the top 10 at the moment. I'd really never thought I would be into Clean Bandit, but I think this is quite a good song.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I wasn't massively sold on Rockabye just because of the whole Ace of Base element to it. So to me, this is a callback to the sort of dizzy heights of Rather Be and No Bad Thing.
At number 2 is Ed Sheeran with Galway Girl, Holding Fast. My theory about this song is that it's going to be a big ironic hit this summer. Everybody who said they've hated it is going to slowly come round to it, and you'll be walking through London Fields or the Moor in Falmouth watching Man Bun Fool sing along to it ironically.
Now, you Man bun fools. Now there's a phrase. Now we have a theory. We've had a theory in, haven't we, Laura? Can you explain the theory?
Yes. Friend of the podcast, John Allison, has suggested that Galway Girl is this generation's tub thumping, which I wasn't sure about until he played it to me last night, because I've always thought of tub thumping as like quite a fun song. I heard it as an 8-year-old. I wasn't ever really involved in the cultural dialogue surrounding it, but he told me that everybody at the time really, really hated it. And I have to concede that I think maybe he's right. It's very structurally similar. All of the elements are present, just kind of jumbled up. He said, if you put a penny whistle on top of tub thumping, it's Galway Girl. And I think there's some similar list-based songwriting in tub thumping, if you can call it songwriting, where they go, he drinks a whiskey drink, he drinks a vodka drink, a lager drink, a cider drink, and there's a bit of old Danny Boying in there. So I think this is a convincing theory. What do you think?
It bears analysis. I think it's clearly unconscious. I'm sure Ed Sheeran is not above purloining influences left and right, but maybe he would go to tub thumping because, you know, he's not as Galway Girl proves, he's not above purloining quite embarrassing influences in a way. Not that the, you know, the Irish music is embarrassing, but to use it in the way that he has whilst referencing Ireland and talking about Irish stuff is somewhat cheesy.
Yes, and in an interview saying, just look how big the cores were. You know, that's his primary reason for mining that sound.
Yeah, you can't bet against the money. Yeah, I think, and I mean, it's an excellent filter of analysis because, you know, maybe it's also encouragement for mashup artists everywhere. So there's the challenge. We need someone to send us the mashup of Tub Thumping and Galway Girl, and we will play some of it on the podcast if it does come in. Reluctantly and in with screams of agony, but we will do it.
I think Radio 1 in the week that the Ed Sheeran album was released, they did mash up C'est La Vie and Galway Girl, and it was even closer than you would have thought from just making a cruel joke about it.
That's the way to do it, in a way. It's fine to bring in fiddle music to pop music and bring the two together. Even desirable. But what you can't do is, you know, basically ramble on about leprechauns and you know, do the St. Patrick's Day Ireland while you're doing it at the same time. It just, I mean, there's on the nose and then there's punched through the nose. And I think that's what Galway Girl is.
And remaining at number one is Ed Sheeran with Shape of You. Which I'm ashamed to say, yesterday I was in a shopping centre and I heard the opening bars of the song. I was like, oh, what's this? This is nice. And then he started singing and I thought, oh, no.
Not least because we've done 5 podcasts in which we talk about this very song.
I was in this old shopping centre where they were doing X Factor auditions as well, and so you could hear that at the same time as hearing something else, but it was quite a disorientating experience. Which this leads us on semi-seamlessly to the meat of today's podcast, the Harry Styles special. Where were you when you first heard Sign of the Times, Fraser?
I actually had to sneak away from the various young people in my house and what they were doing over the Easter holidays to hear it, because I knew that a special pop event was going on. And so I snuck into my office and shut the door and played it irreverently so that I could get the full impact. Where were you, Laura?
I was typically at my desk. I often worry about the fact that I will not have any memories related to pop music in the future because I hear them all sitting at the same desk I'm talking at right now. I'd forgotten it was happening. An email alerted me. And I have to say, I listened to it twice that morning and it didn't really stick. But then yesterday afternoon, I started getting a hankering for it. And I listened to it a number of times and realised that I think I am actually quite a big fan of it. We should listen to a bit.
That's Harry Styles and that's Sign of the Times. And the thing about it I really like is the emotive quality to his voice. He sounds wide open in a way that is, you know, for someone to have come out of a band in which lines were shared between 5 singers and, you know, with that, you know, I really like One Direction. What I really like about them is they remembered that pop music is supposed to be fun. So they weren't the boy band doing the big boy band ballads that, you know, that aimed at that sort of pseudo profundity of, you know, the unfortunate experience that happens in your teenage years that makes you consider why life is cruel for the whole of the rest of your life. That isn't that. they made pop music that was fun. But you don't necessarily get a huge amount of sense of individual personality within a One Direction song. It's just five lads having the time of their lives, which is great. So for Harry, and then Harry comes out, and it's, you know, big, open-hearted, hugely emotive singing. Sounds like he's been through something of an experience, but he's open to the world. And I love that. And actually, the more you hear the song, the more that quality seems to sort of leap out.
Yeah, like you say, because, you know, he was such a fragmented part of the One Direction vocal troupe. If I didn't know this song was him, I wouldn't necessarily have associated it with Harry Styles at all. But obviously the way he's singing on it is a clear way of establishing his vocal presence. I really enjoyed MTV News in America did a roundtable about it. And one of their writers, Sasha Geffen, said that they thought it was the least cynical pop song in years for the way that he sings. And I thought that was quite a lovely way of thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does come across. And it doesn't... I mean, it's interesting because of what we're about to sort of run a kind of assessment check on the song by measuring it up against other solo debuts by former boy banders. And I think the thing is that it doesn't necessarily fit thematically into any pattern that existed before, because, you know, he's by some distance the Robbie Williams of One Direction, but to come out with something that is so not the sound of current pop and also not aping another popular music that's going on at the moment. So, you know, Robbie's early career was largely fixated on the song All Around the World by Oasis and making it again in different ways. And this isn't that. You know, it's got the slide guitar from Angels, but that's about it. There's not a lot of musical precedent within current pop for this particular song.
Yeah, at the New Statesman, Anna Leskovich wrote a very good piece kind of picking apart all of its classic rock influences. And I think she lands upon, you know, the Rolling Stones and Oasis and Bowie and Elton John in there. I have to say, although I do like it, there is a part at the end where you can very kind of clearly hear all the fireworks going off on X Factor on the big emotive Christmas final. And maybe it's just because I've kind of... my exposure to Harry Styles has definitely been him more as like queer Twitter's favourite fantasy girlfriend than an actual pop star in his own right. And so I think because I've engaged with him in that way, I think I wanted it to be much more kind of high camp, but I realised that might not have been kind of the ultimate first move for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely scope for him to go that way, and I would like to see him go that way. I think he's got the capability of suddenly busting an unexpectedly thoughtful Rufus Wainwright style. You know, I was thinking 14th Street Rufus Wainwright, torch song to his own vulnerability, that kind of thing. I'd love to hear him do something like that. But it's interesting also that it's quite John Lennon-y. I think there's an amazing video. I forget the interviewer's name, but he, as part of his showbiz interviews with all sorts of people across the range of show business, always asks John or Paul. And he collected the video of, and collated it together of all the answers that he'd got to that question. And he put it up, and it's about 20 minutes long, and it's loads of people saying, basically just going, "You absolute cruel swine, I can't make that choice, but if I had to, I would choose John." And then, you know, the next one. And there's definitely a theme that emerges that actors generally choose John Lennon over Paul McCartney, because I think there's that being the one, being the sort of leader character, the emotive truth that's ascribed to John as opposed to the craftsman-like skill of Paul, you know. And I think there's something in that to former boy banders. Certainly there's no coincidence that Robbie Williams used to talk about praying to John Lennon for help with songwriting. So he becomes this totemic figure of pure expression, of saying exactly what you want to say because you feel it so deeply, rather than learning your craft as a songwriter and becoming incredibly good at writing music. It's about, you know, the expression. And I think there's an element of being in a boy band that must feel like suppressing or compromising that feeling of expression that makes someone like John Lennon so appealing. And so it's interesting that that one of the touchstones for this song as a sound is the solo work of John Lennon. Definitely doesn't sound like the Beatles, definitely does sound like solo John Lennon.
We should have included them in our ex-boy band member rundown. I don't know, it'd be cruel to call them a boy band, but...
I genuinely thought about it, actually. I thought that we need to, because they are the boy band, and there's certainly the model on which pop music based itself to make those boy bands happen. for years, and I think, you know, you'd be a fool to discount the Beatles as a boy band. But ultimately, they aren't subject to the same rules because there isn't that expectation. Although they were the original band where people said, John is the cynical one, Paul is the charming one, you know, that in the same way the Spice Girls had their own distinct personalities. I think that they either set the template or defied a template, whereas what the people that we will talk about now were working within a template.
Yeah, and this also relates to whether we think Sign of the Times can dethrone Ed Sheeran. My theory is that I think it's going to be a massive hit, but I don't think he can dethrone Sheeran because Sheeran, you know, for all of his folly, codes as quote unquote real music to a lot of people. Whereas because Harry Styles came from One Direction, a manufactured pop band, no matter who he collaborates with, no matter what his influences are, he'll always be seen as a fraud, you know, drawing in all these signifiers to try and make himself look cool. He will never be able to escape that, no matter how good what he does is.
No, exactly. Just like One Direction did when they when they used burbling synthesizers in the vein of Baba O'Reilly by The Who in Best Song Ever, that annoyed more people who should really have thought, brilliant, there's a song in the pop charts that sounds a little bit like Baba O'Reilly by The Who. They were like, how dare they despoil, you know, as if Baba O'Reilly has now suddenly been ruined. I think that there will always be that. Also, it has something of Angels by Robbie Williams to it as a song. And it's important to remember that Angels by Robbie Williams, although by far his most notable, well-liked song, never went to number one. It got to number four. But there again, Harry Styles has one of the most rabid fan bases in all of music, so I wouldn't bet against it, but I my inkling is that you're right.
So we've mentioned Robbie Williams. He is kicking off our total duffers category when it comes to ex-boy band members making their solo breakouts. I think a lot of people forget what Robbie Williams' actual solo breakout was.
Yes, he started with the cover version of George Michael's Freedom 90, which he just called Freedom. And it was a moment where he had... His sort of dalliances with various substances had left him kind of fat-faced and a bit slovenly. Like, he'd come out of take that with that thing of... And like, I kind of understand it. If you've been immaculately groomed from the age of 15 to be magnetically attractive at all times, at the point at which you express yourself as being away from that, you could probably let yourself go a bit. But he was so visibly not... magnetically attractive that they filmed him from the other side of a Venetian blind for part of the video. Like, we're not, and the video is so frantically cut as to not linger on his face for very long, so that anybody could go, "Ooh, he's let himself go, isn't he? Oh dear." And it's all, you know, it turned itself around. This is, you know, but it's definitely a cry of pain of a song. But what I remember him saying at the time, that he was investigating getting into songwriting or maybe working with Guy Chambers at the time. But what he wanted to say as a solo artist had already been so perfectly encapsulated by George Michael that he just nicked the song. So there was something upsetting about watching him do it, not from a musical purist point of view, but because he's clearly not in a good place.
Yeah, he looks quite manic in the video. Yeah, I think he's really kind of failed to make the distinction between doing a George Michael and just doing George Michael. I think it's not the best way to define yourself post-boy band life by being like, oh yeah, remember that other guy? Just like him. But this has been written out of history, so, you know, maybe it wasn't too much of a misstep. He got it out of his system and then he came back with the proper stuff.
Yeah. Then he built himself up slowly by pretending to be Oasis. And it worked, you know, it's not... And that Old Before I Die, which was his, you know, considered to be his first proper solo single, you know, he was able to carve out territory. And he does set a template again for former boy banders to follow, you know, that the rogue spirit that really likes classic rock is something that hadn't really happened before.
Yes, totally. Yeah, there are some definite categories that you see these like post-boy band debut singles falling into. For example, also in our really, really crap list is Nick Carter from the Backstreet Boys' Help Me, which just sounds like him trying to do the Dawson's Creek theme tune or copy the Callings Wherever You Will Go. And then Joey McIntyre from New Kids on the Block, he did Stay the Same, which is just really, really syrupy. And I wonder if he minted negging with this song, because it's all just about, there's nothing about you I would change. I think you could be whatever you wanted to be.
Which is, yeah, definition of faint praise, isn't it? I think you could be whatever you want to be. Could you just get on with it?
Yeah. And then, you know, you get similar ballads from Duncan James from Blue with I Believe My Heart, which is just him trying to do You Say It Best and failing. And then Mark Owen from Take That's Child, which I... feel like it's a ballad. It's really, really syrupy and weedy. You can definitely hear the Lennon complex coming through here. Again, he seems to be singing to himself, "Hero, now that you're free, you have no need to fear." So there's kind of like the drippy post boy band song, which I think is a very obvious route. But then I think my favourite of them is the ones where, sort of in the vein of Freedom 90, but more Freedom, Robbie's cover, but more vituperative, is when they come back and they really want to kick against the pricks and kick against everything they were supposedly before. And there's some fine examples of that in our terrible songs list.
Well, the classic being Brian McFadden from Westlife's Real to Me. I think we should hear a clip from that. So that, there we are. That's Real to Me by Brian McFadden, a song that is just a moan about being famous. So it's not, I've been misunderstood, this is who I really am. It's literally him saying all of the great things that you think about famous people having, you know, the limousines and the people screaming at you. Hey, that's not real. Being in my baby's arms is real. But it's not brave to say, when I was in Westlife, I thought it was all a bit of a sham. I mean, you could see that from the outside. I don't think anybody in Westlife thought that they were artistically expressing themselves. It's absolutely fine to be in Westlife, to come out and to take the rewards of having been in Westlife. To come out and then write a song about how shallow it all is just seems a little rich.
Also, while I'm not entirely sure of the chronology, but was he not married to Kerry Katona at this time? It was a big star of reality TV. Seems a little pot kettle black. I have to say my favourite line in this song, and maybe of one of any songs ever, which he acts out very literally in the video, is when he's talking about the things that are real to him. He says, "I lift up my finger and watch football on TV."
Yeah, yeah, like real people do.
Real man!
Which he could have done while he was in Westlife as well. It's that thing of, I'm not one of you, I'm one of them. It's so manipulative as a song, to write a song that says, hey, you can like me now because I'm no longer in Westlife. I know you all hate Westlife. And it's like, actually, the only people listening to you are people that really like Westlife, Brian. So, you know, maybe think about who you're talking to.
Exactly. And also, he was quite like, you know, it really negates the fact that he seemed to really love being in Westlife. There's a brilliant interview collected in the great Sylvia Patterson book that came out last year, where she goes to interview them and she says she just feels like it's where she comes completely unstuck with pop, because they're just such brazen little capitalists, and everything she levels at them about how bad they are and how shallow it is, their answer is, yeah, but loads of people like it, so who cares? And they do seem like they've got a bit of energy and a bit of vim, and she just goes away feeling totally defeated. And so for him to be like, actually, yeah, none of that stuff was real, and pointing my finger at football on TV is real to me.
Yeah. Sylvia Patterson was right all along.
Yes, exactly.
Can we just pause to say, by the way, I'm With the Band by Sylvia Patterson is one of the best books about music ever written, and that anyone with a passing interest in the stuff that we're talking about now should seek it out post, what's the word? Very quickly.
And also, as a companion, get Tom Hibbert's Who the Hell collected columns from Q, which you can usually pick up for about 20p on Amazon. They make very good bedfellows. Anyway, we'll stick links to these in the notes. Also, with people trying to kiss off their old fans in their old careers, Ben Adams from A1, he released a song called Sorry, where he sings, "Sorry for the mess I made, I effed it up, now I can't be saved." Which, you know, it's like him burning his bridges, but he's really acting like leaving A1 was much more catastrophic than it actually was. This is not a particularly menacing or bad boyish song, and I think A1 were very diminished by the point that he made it anyway.
My thing about A1, A1 were my period of working when I used to work at Top of the Pops, and I interviewed all of them. But the little chap called Paul, I can't remember his surname, so I want to refer to him as the little chap. Paul used to have as his answer phone message himself singing to the tune of Michael Jackson's Bad, "My name is Paul and I'm not in, so leave your name and I'll give you a ring, come on." And that's the most interesting thing I know about A1.
Amazing. And maybe the cream of this particular style of song is Charlie Simpson, ex of Busted, when he remanifested as Fight Star with Paint Your Target.
Yeah, that was the real go away, girls. Stop listening to me. I know you like me when I'm in Busted, but I'm really serious now and intense. And the level of sort of volte-face about Fightstar was so extreme, because the thing with Busted was they seemed to be having such a whale of a time being Busted. They were incredibly funny interviewees, all three of them. They had a really good chemistry. And while it was obvious that he sort of took himself as a musician quite seriously, I don't care if people do or not. I think it's fine to take yourself seriously at times. The level to which he wanted to overthrow that and make hardcore, you know, was difficult to process. And I think it's hard when you do have a fan base that are really into what you're doing to throw that off in a way that doesn't look massively ungrateful. And I think most of the anger within Fightstar, although it's embedded into the musical form that they were trying to make, just looked like petulance. It looked like Charlie Simpson saying, "Go away from me, girls. Stop following me. I want boys to like me now." You know, and they did. You know, some boys did.
Moving on to the quite good ex-boy band solo debut category, I really enjoyed JC Chazé's, if that's how you say his name, from NSYNC's Blow Me Up With Her Love. But unfortunately, Justin Timberlake had already got there first and done it better. But it is from that period of like pretty ironclad R&B crossover pop. It would have been hard for him to misstep here, I think.
Yeah, we'll come on to Justin, but I think people weren't necessarily as sure about him being the person he eventually became until he started making music. At the point at which NSYNC appeared to be splitting up, he was just the good-looking one with the weird hair.
Oh, yeah, there's that type. One that I hadn't thought about since this came out in about 2000 was Buggin' by Dane Bowers, who had left Another Level, where he's featuring on a song by True Steppers, which we're going to hear a bit of. Thought I told you once before, but you keep on knocking at my door. Nothing more here, what's left to say? I made it clear, but you're bugging anyway. The memories of yesterday that once were strong. There are obviously UK Garage is like original UK Garage is a really big influence at the moment, and I think you could hear this on the new Drake mixtape, and I think you can also kind of hear the influence on the XX of this song as well.
Yeah, and also the fact that this expresses really well another a moment of pop music that we've been talking about quite a bit, which is the idea that as a star with a name who wishes to establish themselves as a, you know, a different musical entity, you hook up with a dance producer and you show humility and you push off into that sort of direction. And he definitely did that. And to pick up on UK Garage in 2000 was still quite a new thing to do. It was still an underground, relatively underground form of music that was percolating into the mainstream. And clearly Dane Bowers was attending those kind of clubs and really liked it. So it seemed to come from quite an honest place.
I like that he immediately gets to pay it forward as well. He does his time guesting on the True Steppers track in 2000, and I think his next single is the one where Victoria Beckham guests on his track, which, you know, an all-time classic that has not been included here.
Yeah. Let's move on. So another one we've got on the list of all right solo debuts, Michael Jackson's solo debut, Got to Be There, from 1971, which is a hugely syrupy ballad, but kind of well done. I mean, it's a milking exercise, that one, isn't it? It definitely feels like we know that he's the guy from that band that will go on. You know, we want to maximize his potential, so we'll get him, you know, in the way that the Osmonds were also at the time branching out into releasing solo material, so just to keep the product in the shop. So it's difficult to review as being anything other than an exercise in maintaining a career rather than a specific burning desire to say something.
Yeah, so it's the same with Ronan Keating from Boyzone's When You Say Nothing At All, which, as you pointed out, is less a solo career kickoff and more a streamlining of Boyzone.
Yeah, we're just getting rid of some of the dead weight. They lose the two wingers on either end, Shane and Keith, and Mikey, you know, was never really that big a presence anyway. So it's literally just taking Stephen Gately away and then allowing Ronan to do what he always did.
There are some other songs in this category that I feel are more, they're not necessarily good, but I think you're more just surprised by the fact that they're not awful. Like What You Got by Abs from Five, surprisingly okay. By Omarion from B2K is all right as well. It's quite good personal branding, making his name synonymous with sexiness.
although, Although it was bad branding, because clearly people talk about sexiness now and they don't even remember who Omarion from B2K is. So let's move on to the creme de la creme, the absolute acme of what you should be looking to do with your debut solo single when you've left a boy band. And I think we'll start with the one that is possibly the best. George Michael's Careless Whisper, which was released as a solo single while Wham was still going. So it's got that element of the Ronan Keating situation in that it doesn't sound radically different from a song that could have been made by Wham, but it was specifically made as a solo single for George Michael, even though it was co-written with Andrew Ridgeley when they were first putting the band together. Something in your eyes calls to mind a silver screen. One interesting fact I found out about, which I genuinely didn't know, was that he recorded a version of this song. The first time he tried to record it properly, he went to the Muscle Shoals studio in Alabama and was produced by Jerry Wexler. Now, people who don't know a lot about pop music might not know, but Jerry Wexler was the guy who worked with Ray Charles and turned him into Ray Charles. He worked with Aretha Franklin and turned her into Aretha Franklin. You know, he's one of those chaps that has the ears. You know, he's a proper music guy who knows how to bring together musical synthesis. And the Muscle Shoals studio is where Aretha recorded some of her most incredible soul songs. Somewhere Wilson Pickett became Wilson Pickett at Muscle Shoals. It's a reputation as a soul recording studio is beyond compare. And George Michael went there, recorded with Jerry Wexler, the ears, the studio, all the stars would seem to be in alignment, and he didn't like what he had and came away and re-recorded the song elsewhere. And that's the version of Careless Whisper that we now know, which I just think is amazing.
I think that's brilliant. One thing I really did not know all that much about George Michael as a writer and as a producer until after he had died. But yeah, I had no idea that he basically produced so much of that music as well. He was a genius.
And working within the pop arena, this is why some people get really chippy about the level of accord that's given to rock compared to pop. Working within the pop arena, he wasn't even given the title of genius until he died. Actually, people were, people liked him, like certain songs, but because he's making pop music, it's easy to dismiss it as being fly by night or lightweight or something, and it's not. It's hard to do.
Similarly good, maybe not quite as good, but up there, when Bobby Brown was kicked out of New Edition, he came back with Girlfriend in 1986, which I think very much stands alone. He's not trying to distance himself from New Edition. It's just like, here I am, solo star. I think this is great.
An interesting one that we've also put in the list, because it's an incredible pop song, is Jordan Knight, his solo debut, Give It To You, from 1999, which his first single out after leaving New Kids on the Block, which I think we're going to hear a little moment from now. Sounds great. This really should have hinted at a potential for incredible success, because it's very sexual, it's sung beautifully, and he's a handsome guy and he had the fan base and everything. There was somewhere for him to go, but for some reason it never happened, and he never had another hit single. I mean, arguably he never needed to have another hit single, because he had this one and it's an incredible song, but it just seems like a missed opportunity.
Now, you lobbied very hard for the inclusion of Jerry Halliwell in this list, even though she is not a boy, but because she is very much the Robbie Williams of the Spice Girls, she fits the scheme. So her breakout single was Look At Me. Look at me, you can take it all, because this face is free. Maybe next time use your eyes and look at me. I'm the drama queen, if that's your... Jerry Halliwell gets a lot of stick because I think she doesn't necessarily communicate her ideas very well, and there's a slight air of... Well, she's got a huge ego, which people obviously never like in women and women musicians anyway. She also does seem slightly mad, but I think Look at Me, among many other things that she did, is proof that she is one of pop's great surrealists and conceptualists, and she's incredibly clever. You know, at the start of the video for this song, a screen flashes up saying, "Image is just your imagination, reality is rarely revealed." And then, having come from a band which is divided along the lines of five supposedly different female archetypes, she kind of boils that down to a more, I don't know, like almost like film theory criticism version of that, where she's got, like, I think the vamp and the virgin and the bitch, and there's one other one as well. And the big hook in this song goes superficial expectations, which is brilliant and bizarre. And she has a funeral for Ginger Spice in the video. It's during this massive operatic bit. It's self-referential, but it's also very funny at the same time. She totally pulls it off. I mean, you know, where Robbie Williams came back just by covering Freedom 90, you have Jerry doing a pure George Michael in this video, in the way that he burns a leather jacket in the video for Freedom 90. She holds a funeral for her former self, and it's the only bit in the video that's in colour as well, where she cackles in the coffin as the Union Jack flag is slid over her. I just don't have enough good things to say about Look at Me and this whole era of Jerry Halliwell.
No, well, exactly. And I think the reason why I lobbied so hard to have it included was it's another example of the paradigm where if a woman does a thing that men are associated with, they have to do it 10 times as well and absolutely knock it out of the park in order to get any kind of acceptance that they're even doing it on the same level. And I think that this is exactly that. It's a former member of a really highly regarded, very, very successful pop band who has such a lot of character, such a lot of personality, you know, and in a way the fact that she expresses herself in clumsy ways is also part of her charm. Certainly is for me. I always thought that Jerry was the best. But then smart enough to bring in these concepts to write a song in which the chorus mentions superficial expectations, sing that with a certain amount of feeling, because she was never, you know, considered to be a particularly expressive vocalist. That was never her thing, but that the way that she sings superficial expectations is wonderful. What you also get is, as part of her clumsy mode of expression or perceived clumsiness, anything that she does that's slightly that rings as a slightly false note adds to the charm. So she's in a really lucky situation there, in a sense, but it's because of her. It's pure charisma, that song. It's pure personality.
Yeah, but I do remember from the time, a lot of the kind of more critical public response to this was like, who does she think she is? She's saying, look at her. Yes, we knew she had a huge ego all along. And it's like, yeah, she was in a huge pop band. And also, Look at Me, it's like, I don't know if irony is the right word, but she's playing on this idea of like, image and entertainment. You're not catching her out by saying, well, yes, she's so attention seeking.
I love, and even preempting that criticism is the line, I can even do reality. It's like, yeah, whatever you want me to be, I'll be, but just keep paying me attention. That's what pop stars are like, which for her serves as ironic statement and absolute statement of truth. And it's perfectly fine for her to say it like that.
So from somebody who was very happy to ironically interface with their former self to somebody who wanted to distance himself from it entirely, Zayn Malik with Pillow Talk, which is obviously a lot more recent.
Yeah, he's the Shane Lynch of One Direction, only with talent. So he's the angry boy, the angry boy in the neighbourhood that all, if you're going to have boy next door characters in your boy band, one of them has to be a bad boy. And Zayn is that guy, you know, clearly physically uncomfortable with the happy elements of One Direction or with the joy of One Direction, and has to look a little bit fed up all the time, but not necessarily moaning about it. But and then when they get to release a solo record, it has to play on the bad boyness, and the bad boy thing is very much, oh, the things I could do to you.
Oh, yeah. When this song first came out, I thought, well, yeah, it's fine. I'm not really that bothered about it. And I heard it one day in the back of a taxi when I was incredibly tired. And that massive melodic leap in the chorus just made me cry involuntarily. And I thought, oh, actually, this is definitely doing something at a certain level, isn't it?
Yeah. And it is all, as we've said, with everything else, it's all in the execution. And he does it so well. That sleepy quality in his voice that we talked about with regards to his current single really, really works in this one as well, because, you know, just because of the pure sex that's going on. I can't talk about sex without putting inverted commas around it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Our final person in the creme de la creme category, I think, you know, somebody who alongside George Michael is really defined the path of what you can do after you leave a boy band, is obviously Justin Timberlake, having left NSYNC and releasing Like I Love You.
Which is just an incredible song, and it totally transformed who Justin Timberlake was. He was the one with the stupid haircut in NSYNC. He was clearly thought of as being very good looking, but that's not enough. And NSYNC weren't. Well, although they played with the whole idea of boy bands being controlled by record labels and all of that stuff, they were a bit, for a British pop audience, I think they were considered something of a dunderheaded pop entity.
They were a bit slick.
Yeah, and for him to then work with the Neptunes, which, you know, commercially makes sense from the Neptunes' point of view, but to make the Neptunes be this good and to come out with these astonishing songs. And basically, he went from being a the most likely to in a boy band that were purely judged on commercial terms to being spoken of as being the new Michael Jackson in a heartbeat. And it absolutely made sense. So to the point where the fact that Justin Timberlake used to be in NSYNC is now an interesting footnote in his career rather than the defining moment of his life because of how good his first solo album was. And it's a great album.
Yeah, absolutely. This song also, I think you can look at this song as a particular, almost as one of the epicenters of modern pop. Its feelings are still reverberating. The main players on this song are still controlling the way that pop music sounds. Justin Timberlake may be having to associate with the Trolls soundtrack to have those kind of hits, but he's still having them. And Pharrell, you know, is absolutely not diminished, whether it's the sound that he created still reverberating through pop, or whether it's him minting new pop stars like Maggie Rogers, who's made an entire career off his approval.
Yeah, and I think that the Harry Styles song, just to bring it back to point, the Harry Styles song, while it has a lot of expressive weight, it hasn't transformed Harry Styles in the way that Like I Love You transformed Justin Timberlake. What remains to be seen is what happens next, obviously. But, you know, I think it's up there, though. I think the more I listen to the Harry Styles song, the more I think, okay, this is so good. And it does illustrate perfectly who Harry Styles is outside of the confines of being in One Direction, that, you know, it's possibly in the creme de la creme section. What do you think?
I think it could climb up there. I think the video might transform it. I'm obviously as excited as everybody by that shot of the stunt double wearing the horrendous Harry Styles mask flying through the air. Just the fact that this video contains somebody zip wiring through the air at a very high altitude, I think sets it up for big things.
Yeah, come on, Harry. See what happens next.
I'm looking forward to a level of ridiculousness in the video that doesn't quite come through in the song, but I think it should complement it well.
Excellent. I also wanted to say about the song that if the Flaming Lips had released it, people would be praising it to the skies and it would be on Six Music all the time. So I think we have to just sonically hear it as well as hear it in context of who's released it.
Oh, and lyrically as well. Like, you know, we talked about all of the different lyrical paths that somebody can take after coming back from a boy band. I think he's probably the first person to leave one of the world's biggest boy bands and come back with a love song about, you know, staying strong in the face of the apocalypse. It's very fitting in 2017.
But and odd, because it doesn't seem like the apocalypse is something that he needs to unduly concern himself with. So yeah, well done.
He's setting himself up as somebody who's ready to confront the big themes, the biggest themes.
Who knows what will be coming next.
So Fraser, what was your most streamed song this week?
I have a very similar feeling that we discussed about Jerry Halliwell for Kate Nash. I think that there are times where she expresses herself quite clumsily. I think that she has a burning passion to express herself and say things, and what she says about what she's doing doesn't always tally up with what she's doing. So I think it's really interesting that over her last album, a couple of albums, or her last album, she was talking very explicitly about being a girl artist, recording, you know, girl type stuff for girls, and amassing a kind of army of supportive girls around her. But her actual, apart from Foundations, a lot of her bigger songs before that were explicitly critical of other girls, you know, those girls. So, you know, there's that mishmash of kind of, you're taking part, you're also part of the problem as much as you want to be part of the solution. But there's an incredible enduring frailty to her voice that I love. The new song that she's just released is called Call Me. It's part of her Kickstarter campaign to have her fourth album funded. I think she's somebody that should make a fourth album. I think the album is something that I want to hear. And Call Me, which we can hear a small section of it now.
Oh,
So that's Call Me by Kate Nash. And as you can hear, she's sort of moving slightly back away from the Riot Girl stuff into the classic Kate Nash, slightly 60s influence stuff that she did on her second album. But she's brought her voice with her. So it's got the undertone of the Courtney Love screaming thing that she likes to bring in as well. And I think it's a really good match. So musically, I like it. But everything about Kate Nash, I find incredibly interesting.
My most streamed song this week is Shadows, which is a duet between Future Islands, Samuel T. Herring from their new album, and Debbie Harry. Just out of tune. This is from Future Islands' fifth album, and obviously the last one was the big breakout. They did that song Seasons on David Letterman, and a viral hit was born. And I really worried that when they were coming to follow it up, you know, they were a cult band before that, they were a tiny band, and then their fan base exploded massively on the back of this one moment. And, you know, when you've got such a fair weather fan base in such a precarious time to exist as a band of their level, how much you have to continue to appease them when you do something new. And I think a lot of people have said that this new album is not particularly interesting, it doesn't do anything that new, and it doesn't musically, but I think it's a lot sadder than any of the ones that came before. The lyrics are really a man at total crisis point, but it has, you know, this perfect tragic arc in the album where it starts bad, it gets really incredibly bad in the middle. There's a beautiful song called Through the Roses, which he said is a song about contemplating suicide, but then the last half of the album, it's like he's trying to pick himself back up. And on Shadows, they got Debbie Harry in. They were trying to think of a voice that would be appropriate for it, and they picked her. And I think he said to her that he wanted her to be something like the spirit calling from the other side, trying to pull him back through and like pull him back to life. And just the melody of this song is so gorgeous. The interplay of their voices is amazing. He sounds a bit diminished and not quite as kind of, you know, bear-like and roaring as he did on the last album. And there's something about Debbie Harry, who's 71 now. She sounds kind of sexy and wise and also encouraging in this song. There's this great line in it where she says to him, "These old shadows parade you like a fool." And it's like she's encouraging him so kindly just to kind of like come back and come back to life. It's one of those songs that when I listen to it in the course of the album, I get stuck on playing it about six times through before I can move on to the next one. I think it's beautiful.
She has one of those voices that should have gone by now. You know, because it exists in that middle range, that purring middle range that vanishes with time. It's why Paul McCartney's voice nowadays sounds like a slightly broken clarinet. And her voice should really have gone, and it just hasn't, has it? It's astonishing.
Thanks for listening and subscribing to One Break My Chart. You can email your thoughts on the charts or reviews of any particular chart-bothering songs or artists to unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com. If you're listening outside the UK, we really want to know about what's going on in your home chart, particularly any regional anomalies that are not penetrating ours, so please do get in touch.
And if you want to listen to any of the songs we discussed in this week's podcast, either the ones that we like or the really awful solo singles, but no Ed Sheeran, sadly, we've got a Spotify playlist which you can find in the show notes.
I like to think that by not putting Ed Sheeran on our Spotify playlist, we're not encouraging his streaming figures. We're doing our bit. We're denying him maybe 12 listens.
A million listens, and we've got a lot of listeners, Laura. Now don't you do us down now. We're basically raising the floor level, the signal to noise with Ed Sheeran. We're going to drown him with other signals.
You can find us both on Twitter. I'm at Laura Snapes, and you are
at @CSI_popmusic.
And our producer is the great Tay Mawson, and we would love it if you left us a review on iTunes. Please tell your friends, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.